Why?
Why?
If you
Why?
Have T-Mobile 5G home internet, you might be hearing this
Why?
A lot.
Why?
Every time your internet slows down during the busiest hours.
Why?
Why?
Because your network gives priority to cell phone users.
Why?
Why?
Good question. Why not switch to Cox Internet with 2x faster download speeds than T-Mobile 5G home internet during peak hours?
Okay.
Stop the whys and visit cox.com/5G home for details. T-Mobile prioritizes certain T-Mobile phone users over home internet users during times of congestion.
How powerful is Cox Internet? So powerful that one day, your daughter will be able to simulate a soccer match against some of the world's best players right from your backyard. Get gig speeds powered by fiber from Cox. It's internet built for tomorrow, today. Internet delivered through Cox's hybrid fiber coax network. Speeds vary and are not guaranteed. Cox terms and other restrictions apply.
Hey, what's going on, nomads and entrepreneurs? I hope you're well, hope you're healthy, and I'm super excited to be back with another episode of the Nomad Entrepreneur. And speaking of the Nomad Entrepreneur, as you may have noticed, this podcast has recently rebranded from what it used to be to the new name that it is now, the Nomad Entrepreneur. This change has happened every single time, and it's no surprise that it's happened to this podcast because of the direction that I see this podcast will be going towards the future, talking about the things that really matter to living a life of fulfillment, a life of happiness. A lot of people who watch, if you're watching on YouTube, and a lot of people who listen, wherever it is you get your episodes from, are entrepreneurs and freelancers and people who want to build a business, either as a one-person solo founder or as a founder of a bigger company serving hundreds and thousands of people. And I think the things that we'll be discussing here and the people that we'll be having on will be a reflection of that, sharing the story about how they build businesses, about how they have gone on to the things that you are wanting to do or that you aspire to do. And this episode is a huge reflection of that new direction because I am joined by Rachel Rannoch, the co-founder and CEO of Weethos, a tool that is described as the first all-in-one freelance software platform. Rachel is a former freelancer and made over $1 million. Now, get that, made over $1 million as a freelancer. And she went on to build an agency with all the lessons and learnings as a freelancer and agency owner with a business partner, after which she went on to found Weethos. And in just under 2 years, Weethos is amassed and currently serving over 80,000 freelancers at various stages of growth, from pricing to proposals to invoicing and payment solutions, which is almost like the biggest headache anyone can face, especially if you're just getting started on this journey. So we talked about what it means to be a high-earning freelancer and founder and the little details that is often not talked about day to day. And quite honestly, this was easily one of the best episodes I've done. And I hope that you find it as interesting as I did. And I've got a special deal for you, the listener of this podcast. You can get access to 30 days of all the pro features of Weethos by using the link in the description or in the show notes wherever you get your podcast from. Meaning you get access to all of the pro features of Weethos for 30 days. And also, if you want to read more about all the media features of Weethos, you can go to rachelrannoch.com/press. That's RachelRennoch.com/press. And I'll leave all the relevant links in the show notes or in the description if you're watching on YouTube. So without further ado, let's grab our headphones and let's dive right into this episode. But before I do that, let us cue the intro. I'll see you on the other side. Welcome to Nomad Entrepreneur, the podcast for digital nomads and remote working entrepreneurs who are living life on their own terms. I'm your host and fellow nomad, Daniel Falonikbe, and I'm excited to bring you conversations with inspiring individuals who are building businesses from anywhere in the world. Each episode will dive into their stories, tips, and strategies for creating a successful and fulfilling location-independent lifestyles. So grab your headphones, kick back, and join me as I explore the freedom and adventure of the nomadic life. Let's get started. All right, so I have Rachel Rannoch, the CEO and co-founder of Weathos. She self-describes herself as a creative monster, ditched the agency life to build a $1 million freelance business, and went on to found this this company that helps freelancers and anyone who wants to take their craft online and help them just give them support and everything they need to, you know, build something that, you know, could sustain them. And thank you for joining me today, Rannoch. I'm so excited to have you here.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm excited to jump in.
Interesting. So, first of all, I just like to get to know, you know, you know, what your background is, and if you can just like tell me everything that I need to know, like where did you grow up? How did that background shape you to where you are right now, and just everything in between, and, you know, just all that good stuff before becoming who you are today.
Yeah. I know it's been kind of a crazy journey for me. Honestly, I think my parents are still confused. But I grew up in Syracuse, New York, which is like upstate middle of New York, but in like a super small town. And I, you know, I'd always sort of been a creative kid, I guess. And I ended up going to art school, at Syracuse University. I actually went there for communications design, and I'd been really into the fine arts to start. Like I did a lot of drawing and painting, but I kind of felt that I needed something more, I don't know, strategic to wrap my mind around, something that was a little bit more grounded. And I found that design really had a great combination of, you know, creative problem solving, as well as, you know, being grounded basically in real problems in the world that can be solved. So I ended up majoring in communications design, which is basically the means of communication through whatever medium. So I was doing work across, you know, exhibit design, magazine, website, just kind of any medium that you can communicate in, just learning how to do that, how to design for those spaces. When I graduated, I basically went right down to New York. I got a job like 2 weeks out of school, working as an art director on the CoverGirl account at an agency in New York. And at that time, digital media was still very much on the rise. So a lot of agencies were still, and they still are, honestly, very much focused on traditional TV production. But I was working on one of the first accounts that was really transitioning over into digital media, which was CoverGirl. So I was doing a lot of work for their Instagram account, which was super fun, shooting nail polish, things like that, just having fun with it. And after a year, I left and I went over to Havas, which is where I met my current co-founder, Claire. So Claire was on the account side of the agency business, which means that she was really doing a lot of the client management. She was doing a lot of like the scoping of the work, the budgeting. She knew, unfortunately, how much we were charging the clients and how much we were all getting paid. We worked together on the Hershey's account at that agency. So we worked across all the different candy brands like Jolly Rancher, Kit Kat, et cetera. And we left a couple of years ago, basically, to start our own freelance studio. And we left for two main reasons. One was we wanted to do more meaningful work. So we just wanted more control over the types of projects that we were working on. And the second reason was because, you know, we were sort of watching and seeing a lot of agencies in our agency kind of lose big accounts to small studios. So we were basically seeing as these big, big, big agencies, they're very expensive. They're really structured for TV production, which is expensive. It takes a long time. TV commercial can run on TV for years sometimes. Digital media has a completely different production value, basically. Mm-hmm. And so you have to create a lot of content. It still has to be high quality, but it has a shorter shelf life, meaning, you know, an ad on Facebook maybe runs a couple of weeks, maybe a couple months at the most before it sort of exhausts itself and you have to refresh the creative. And there's really like this important piece around digital media where you need to be relevant and timely. And that's really tough to do. So now you need like volume, speed, and quality, which
right.
If you talk to any like agency or any creative person, they'll tell you that age old tale that you can't have all three, like pick one, good, fast, cheap, pick one.
Right. Absolutely.
But I do think that the model and the system itself was just not designed to deliver on that. And by being a smaller, more nimble sort of studio, we could actually deliver on that because not only did digital media rise, but also all of the equipment got better. You can shoot 4K on your iPhone at that time.
Right.
You know, you don't need a big movie theater size screen. So a lot of the things that agencies were, you know, their specialty, they were there for, were sort of getting to become like just less valuable, frankly, and more, distributed into the hands of other people. So we left. We started our own freelance studio. That business grew really fast. We did like $1.4 million in revenue in like 18 months.
Wow.
And that's when we found out how painful it is to scale a service-based business. And it's painful to scale a service-based business because when you're running a service-based business and you're selling things, you're effectively selling something that hasn't happened yet, right? So absolutely. I'm giving you an estimate. I'm giving you a quote. Here's what I think it'll cost. Here's what I think will happen. Now, when you invoice your clients, you're billing them usually looking back. So you're billing them for things that have already happened. So right. The gap between what you thought would happen and what does happen can be tiny. It can be huge depending on the project. And it's like normal for scopes to change, you know, throughout the course of something. But we didn't really have a good feedback loop between those two systems. Mm. I mean, it was really challenging to understand, you know, like, how much money are we really making? And this business, and I think in particular, has that challenge because of the way that a service-based business sort of works. So that's when we, you know, got to work on our own operating system to sort of solve for these issues. And the like big pain point around scaling a service-based business is that in order to deliver more services, you need more right. people. More people create more financial and operational complexity. So now, like, what should this cost and how much should we charge? Like, all those things get even harder to determine, more complicated. So anyway, got to work on our own system. We built that out end to end. And in 2019, we raised a $3 million venture capital round to basically consumerize that platform for release. And so our story sounds a lot like Shopify's. We essentially built a system. We realized that the value of that system was more valuable than even just like our one individual studio. And that's when we decided, like, how can we make it so that other people can leverage, you know, the tools that we've built to basically streamline their workflows. But really what it's about is helping them then find teammates and also scale up right. And reducing the amount of complexity that is required in order to scope a more complex project and send payments to collaborators, et cetera. So that summer, like 2020, after the pandemic hit, we were getting tons of calls from our friends who were, you know, creative directors, new to freelance. And they're like, how do I put scope work together? And so we onboarded our first 100 freelancers that year. And then at the end of 2020, we launched publicly. We now have over 80,000 businesses using the platform. And it really does solve that end-to-end problem from, you know, scoping all the way through to billing and payments. But at the end of the day, what we're really aiming to do here is we want to take the guesswork out of running this kind of business. We want to take the guesswork out of running a freelance business. And there is so much guesswork today that goes into it, from how much should I charge to how much money am I really making to which types of projects and clients should I be really going after. Like, your challenges as a freelancer are really specific and contextual to your business, but those challenges typically are sort of extrapolated to the whole audience. Like, every freelancer has similar challenges, but the data they need to really understand what's going on with their business is really contextual to their business. So Our goal really is to become like a co-pilot. We want to guide you on, you know, making better business decisions faster. And we really try to leverage data to do that.
That's interesting. I mean, what really struck me from everything that you've said is the growth, or the super fast growth, I should say, from going from individual creatives who just like are good at what they do to finding a co-founder or like a business partner, and going from basically zero in your business to $1.4 million in 18 months. As someone who has been in the freelance game for a long time now, and I know a lot of people who watch this or who I communicate to on a daily basis are in that realm as well. You know, this is like something that, I mean, a lot of people can wrap their heads around this. So what is that growth like from zero to find a co-founder or a partner to 1.4? Like, is it as seamless as it sounds now? Because to me, it just feels like everything that you touch just, you know, turns to gold. I don't imagine that's the case, you know? So like, what are the little intricacies of like trying to figure things out and, you know, trying to put like things in place, you know, finding clients? And I just want to like just dissect that a little bit and just tell me more about that and how all of that like just came together within 18 months.
For sure. For sure. So I would say, like, definitely the overnight thing is not real. There was a lot of work that went into the business even before we left our jobs to start the business. And then I will also say that being in the agency world to start gave us an advantage. We had a built-in network. We had a professional network already. And I think that one thing about running a freelance business is that your business is your network is your business. And so ultimately, if you're coming from the agency world, you are going to have an advantage when you enter the space just because you've built a professional network, and people typically tend to refer, or freelancers hire their freelancers all the time for bigger projects, things like that. if you're not coming from that kind of a background, which we have a lot of customers that are not traditional, they're young, maybe right out of college or even in college, they're freelancing, and then they get out and they're like, I don't want a traditional path, and I'm going to go straight to that. And that is absolutely doable and possible. It takes longer for sure, because you are starting a bit like from zero. Whereas, right. You know, when we were starting, we did have a portfolio already. We had a track record. We had worked on big brands. You know, all those things made it much, much, much easier to enter the space. So that definitely was a big advantage of ours. Now, the other thing I'll say from a growth standpoint is what we found when we entered the market, there was a couple of things that we did to drive sort of growth quickly. One was, before we quit our jobs, we were starting to line up clients to begin with. And so, you know, we were reaching out to people from our network, sending emails like, hey, you know, I'm available for freelance, or tweeting, like things like that, and just kind of getting a trickle of sort of inbound interest to kind of build up a good reputation. Right. And then once we left, what we were really doing is we really wanted to assess, like, how do we quote unquote go to market? Like, how do you go to market as a freelancer? How do you differentiate yourself? How do you, you know, enter a space that is maybe not really competitive or crowded? And what we actually did was we had a big client base of nonprofit organizations. And I know that that sounds contradictory to the $1.4 million, but the nonprofit sector contributes like trillions of dollars to the GDP every year. There's a lot of money there, and they're underserved. They're overworked. They desperately need help, especially with like communications and design. And it's not super competitive because a lot of agencies, freelancers, et cetera, like they go after the sexy D2C brands. Right. They go after, like, we want to be the next Casper. We didn't really care about that. We wanted meaningful work. And we found that by entering a space that was underserved, that also gave us an advantage, right? We weren't starting from trying to compete with a million other agencies or whatever it is in a for-profit's inbox. Nonprofits were not getting a lot of attention. They needed a lot of help. And because they don't hire a lot of people full time, they do have funds for outsourcing. So that was a big thing, which is like, and so my big piece of advice, I guess I would say, is like, find the right target audience, find a white space or an opportunity or an underserved market. And that can help drive growth a lot faster than trying to compete, you know, in a sea of other voices. The other thing that drove a lot of growth is the offering and differentiating the offering. So by the nature of working with nonprofit organizations, what happened is, they were coming to us and they were asking us for like campaigns. So for instance, we did a work in 2018 to recruit people to work in polling stations for the midterm elections, because in 2016, the lines were really, really, really long. And a lot of people just didn't get to vote because of it. So they needed to recruit like really specific zip codes, more people to sign up to become poll workers to help keep the lines moving. So, you know, we talked to this nonprofit organization, they're looking to hire one freelancer. That's a whole campaign. That's, you need an agency for that.
Right.
And it got us sort of thinking like, well, what is an agency? Or an agency is just more people. Okay. More people need to tackle this. We've got people. We've got a huge network. Why don't we start assembling these sort of project-based teams for our clients? And that's where things really took off. They loved the offering. It was, you know, it was like the power of an agency at the fraction of the cost. But at the same time, we were able to pay our people well, because we didn't have overhead. We had basically no overhead. We call it a virtual studio, sort of the idea. Right. So it's just people. So if you're able to collaborate and coordinate and figure out what to charge and what to pay people, et cetera, and then you're able to calculate a margin on that, that business can grow really fast, because instead of picking off $1,000 projects here and there, now we're picking off $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 deals. And being able to do bigger projects opened up just so much more growth for us than just trying to go after sort of projects that are limited to one individual. So personally, like, I believe the future of freelance is collaborative, like, period. I think unlocking the ability to team up with others, pitch bigger projects, will ultimately lead to people taking on bigger paychecks and, you know, enable them to compete with the big agencies who are sucking up billions of dollars right now. And that should be redirected to independence. That's my goal.
Wow, that's pretty cool, like, hearing that story. So what I take away from that is, you know, you already had this experience working on bigger projects with, you know, some, you know, probably, you know, some reputation, and that really like gave you sort of like edge start when you decided to, you know, go solo, you know, and start getting all those projects by yourself. And you also mentioned something really important, you know, the future of freelance is collaborative. And a lot of people, especially getting into the freelance world, they think, okay, one, if you feel freelancer, you have to be solo. So you're saying that it doesn't necessarily have to be that way. It can, you know, be an advantage to actually find people aligned with the same goals and just like go all in together. They say, like, if you want to go faster, you go alone. If you want to go farther, you go together. And that's a really interesting concept right there. But so let's transition into this, you know, behemoth of a company that you founded, Weethos, in the space of,
you know. I told you my parents are confused, so.
I mean, I honestly, I say to my friends all the time, personally, like, my mom, I mean, she probably sometimes still doesn't know what I do. And she just knows that I work, I survive. What do? I try to explain so many times and she still doesn't get it. And that's okay. Maybe she probably never will. And that's all right. I think that's just a tendency parents, you know, have. So tell me about, you know, Weethos, the idea for, you know, Weethos itself. You already have this like huge network of, you know, freelancers and creatives who were already ready to, you know, come on board. Was that something like you decided overnight, or was it a decision that was based on the fact that we have this resources of people? Because I mean, I know of a few, you know, startups that were founded based on the fact that they already had.
How powerful is Cox Internet? So powerful that one day your daughter will be able to simulate a soccer match against some of the world's best players right from your backyard. Get gig speeds powered by fiber from Cox. It's internet built for tomorrow, today. Internet delivered through Cox's hybrid fiber coax network. Speeds vary and are not guaranteed. Cox terms and other restrictions apply.
You know, the user base, they didn't think of them as users, but just like a resource of people that they can later on onboard. I mean, mm-hmm. I can think of a few examples. Was Weethos based on that idea that, you know what, we have this giant network. We have this, you know, this capabilities as individuals. We've already put in, you know, hours and hours to put like the systems in place. How can we transition this into something bigger that can serve a lot of people? Was that really the idea, or was it something else?
Yeah. So, oh man, the transition from services to software was probably one of the, I think it was the hardest part about this business. And so I've been running the business for now 7 years. So that whole overnight thing, definitely not real. the software is about like 2 years old. So all of the things that happened sort of leading up to the software sort of laid the foundation for everything else. And the way that we think about this, and you know, you make a good point about like, I didn't necessarily think about it as like users of a platform. I think that today, when you think about the freelance space and you think about the tools that are sort of available to people,
right,
you have a couple of different buckets and lanes in which people do things. On one end of things, you have like business management, like how you manage your business, maybe how you manage your finances, your sales pipeline, et cetera. Then you have sort of a lane of marketplaces, really, which is where you're supposed to allegedly find work. Now, the marketplaces in general, if you go to Upwork.com or you go to Fiverr.com, like, the landing page, the homepage, is geared towards the client side. And so if you're ever wondering, like, who do they serve? that tells you who they serve. And so I don't think that they've really built out the things that their service providers need. And they see people as, like, supply and demand. And we see that very, very, very differently. It's kind of the difference between, like, Amazon and Shopify. Like, we want to power their businesses under their own brands. We don't want to get in the middle of everything. And that, I think, is a big sort of difference between how we approached it. The third bucket is like community and network building. And so that's like social media. That's like LinkedIn and Behance and Instagram and Dribbble and just all the places in which you sort of connect with people, find community, and build your network. Now, my problem or my challenge is these three systems are separate in the world today. But again, as a freelancer, your network is your business is your network. And so the place where people find work and the place where people build community are so separate that it's actually creating a disadvantage, and it is making it so that in the marketplace model, we have created sort of a race to the bottom. You know, the clients have the power to say, like, if you won't do it for $5, I'll find somebody who will.
Right.
Which sucks.
It does suck. That's really what goes on platforms like, you know, Upwork and Fiverr. Like, it's just everybody competes on price, and it's just like you said, it races to the bottom. Like, it goes to zero first.
Totally, yeah. And so, like, I think that also from my perspective, when what we hear from people, and when you look at the data, the vast majority of people get work from their professional networks. Second to that is social media networks. And then third is like marketplaces and, you know, job boards and things like that. Like the service-based business is very people-oriented and it's very network-oriented. So I think that there's a big disadvantage there by not having the network be able to connect with one another. So we really wanted to approach this differently. We wanted to approach it from a place of like, let's not try to fit into an existing sort of bucket. We call our system kind of a market network. There is actually a network built into it that you can browse, you can join the network, you can help bring people onto projects, but we don't have a marketplace where a client can come in and necessarily hire people, because again, it creates a very different dynamic. And a big part of our approach is transparency, pricing transparency. How much are people charging? And I think that for us, we wanted to be super thoughtful and specific about who takes advantage of that and who gets that power. We could have built plenty of pricing tools for the clients. Like, how much does a website cost? Like, there's, I still think there's a big opportunity there, but then you have to kind of ask yourself, like, who am I giving power to when I do that? And I don't, I'm not here to empower the people that are already in power, frankly.
You already have it. Let's just shift the dynamic a little bit.
Like, so I think there's something very, very exciting and interesting about like arming the rebels, as they say, you know, like empowering like a grassroots movement of people who have no transparency, who are shooting in the dark. And by the way, no other business functions like this. If you sell books online, if you're an e-commerce store, if you sell t-shirts, you know how much t-shirts cost, you know how much t-shirts sell for. Shooting in the dark, it truly continues to only just put like the people in power at an even bigger disadvantage or advantage, I mean. So anyway, we really thought a lot about like the dynamics of a network, the dynamics of power structures, the dynamics of like what exists today and what's broken about it. And we tried to kind of incorporate that into the business software itself so that they don't feel like separate things, but they really feel like a home for your business. All my friends are here. All my finances are here. Like, why would I ever leave? And that's kind of the sort of the end goal that we're trying to get to.
That's quite interesting. And quite honestly, like I haven't thought about it. I mean, I didn't dig into, you know, the software itself and saw a lot of these things that you're talking about. So it's sort of like there's a social, a social media kind of stuff built into where we can just connect and, you know, discuss projects. Is that what I'm hearing? Cause I think that's what I'm hearing. So like maybe we can just talk to each other. Like, how's it going with you? Like, how much are you charging for this project and things of that nature? That's quite beautiful. And I was just browsing through Upwork, you know, a few days ago, and they're trying to incorporate that as well. And I think they're just like really late on that. Now you can add people as friends and you can collaborate on projects. I'm just like, no, I'm not really interested in that. Like, I mean, it doesn't do me any good for now. You know, at least I haven't seen the value in that. So you are empowering the creatives rather than giving power to those who, you know, currently have it. That's quite interesting. So tell me about the structure of the company as it is right now. How big is it? How big is the community? How fast was the adoption? I mean, there's a million questions I just want to ask, but let's start with that. You know, let's just, you know, peel the curtain on that a little bit.
Yeah, for sure. So, my company's still small. We're only like 12 full-time people. We support on the platform about 80,000 users. They're on the platform. It's pretty intense, but I think from our perspective, we have like a big focus on constantly improving the product and also making sure that we are there for them from a customer service standpoint. The other thing that I see a ton that is such a disappointment, honestly, because like I ran a business like this, and if you are using a platform to run your business and that platform is breaking or buggy or whatever, that's one thing. But then if you also can't get a hold of somebody to help you, your whole day, your whole week is just like, that'll send you into a panic, honestly. Absolutely. And I think like a lot of these other platforms, they just don't or maybe can't care enough about the freelancer side because they are focused on the client side, right? And so for us, like we're really responsive. We really want to make sure that if there is an issue or is a problem, because, you know, we're still a newer company and we're still making the software better, that like we are at least your partner there and we know this is where you run your business and we take it seriously. Like, we take you seriously. And I think that that is a feeling that a lot of freelancers just don't get elsewhere. Like, they want to be taken seriously and they should be taken seriously. And they are like founders. I see them as founders of businesses. So that's something that's super important to us. From like an adoption standpoint, I mean, it's tough. Like, I'm not gonna lie. So when we launched the first MVP, the way we went to market, and this is also, I think, something important to note from like a software standpoint, we were really intentional about the first 100 people on the platform. So we actually like went out and found a diverse group of people all across the US to make sure that we weren't just getting like coastal cities. They were diverse in gender, they were diverse in race, they were diverse in everything, basically background, everything. Because we knew that the first 1,000 users were likely going to be their networks. And if we can make sure that we have a diverse set to start, then the network effects are so much more powerful than if we were to just go to like New York and onboard a bunch of our friends that, you know, we're in one community essentially. So that is a huge reason why growth, why we drove growth so quickly, because of the sort of seeding of the user base. And then the second thing is, I'm of the opinion for sure that you have to create something of value for people in order to bring them to you. And so the pricing data was a big driver of that growth early days and now. Meaning when we first launched, we wanted to establish sort of trust with the community, because not everybody wants to share what they charge. And it's a precarious topic, you know, like we weren't sure. So we published our own first. We published all of our own data. Here's what we were scoping things for. Here's how we break down websites. Here's what each service is that we charged for. Here are our profit margins. We just started to publish our own data. And that's when things really started to take off. People were really excited about the idea of like a crowdsourced recommendation based on how other people are charging. And so now if you fast forward to today, you know, we started out with a database basically of like a couple hundred individual services, and then like 20 fully built, you know, scopes of work proposals for like social media, website, brand strategy, stuff like that. Now today we have thousands of services across dozens of different industries. We also have hundreds of like templates that are pre-built, pre-priced out. And essentially the way that the platform is structured is that we have a free tier for, usually that's good for people who are freelancing on the side. So you don't have to pay a monthly subscription, and you can use scoping and invoicing and payments. And then we have a pro tier, which is $15 a month. And that sort of unlocks a lot of the extra data that really helps you take the guesswork out of your business. So things like the intelligent pricing recommendations, access to the whole template database, you know, the ability to build out your own sort of templates and libraries so you can quickly put things together, et cetera. And so that's kind of, we wanted to make sure that it was accessible to a larger, to like a huge portion of the market, because later this year, we're likely going to roll out our teams tier, which is currently in beta. And that is going to help people facilitate not just finding teammates and adding them to projects, but actually being able to pay other people on the platform, which today, if you're running this kind of business, you're using 5 different tools to do this. If you have subcontractors, it's such a nightmare. It's such a nightmare. Like, nothing is built for this. Nothing's built for this. So we want, it's like Venmo meets, like, not QuickBooks, because that thing's too complicated.
But DocuSign and, you know, a lot of these like, things.
Totally. And there's like this really powerful peer-to-peer thing that I think if we can make, like, my big question for us today is, if we were to make teaming up easier and more accessible, like less complicated, less risky, like, oh man, who's going to do the cash flow management? Who's going to do whatever? If we can make that easier with software, which we can, how many more people would be doing it? And I think that that is a big, powerful question that we hear all the time from our users. Like, I team up occasionally, but I would be doing it more, or I want to do it. I just haven't, like, I haven't had the ability to try yet. So I think that opening up that opportunity and making it easier with software is just going to be a big driver of helping people, like I said, earn more money, which is really our North Star. Like, it's just to help people make more money. I'm not here to help you with productivity. I'm here to help you with profitability. And that's a very, very different kind of product.
That's super interesting. I mean, you unpacked a lot here, but I want to focus on, there's two tiers to this conversation that we're having right now, especially for people who watch the channel and listen to the podcast. There's people who are freelancers full-time who sort of like, you know, travel, because I do a lot of content about traveling and working remotely, freelancing, and, you know, just making money, because travel isn't fun if you're not making money. You can be, you know, hitting like $1 ramen on the streets of Bangkok every time. That shit gets old pretty fast. And there's this tier of other people who are building things, you know, just building companies like you are right now, albeit remotely, right? So you have claimed that your platform helps people make money. And I think it really does. It's like a breath of fresh air, right? How does it do that for that guy who's just, or that girl who's just watching right now thinking, I mean, it sounds cool, but is it just another platform? How do I really like increase my bottom line by just being on this platform? Was it, I mean, what does it really offer me from a granular standpoint? Mm-hmm. If you can touch on that, then we can talk about, you know, the person, the, you know, that is you behind the whole thing, you know, things like hiring and building a team and things. But let's just start from that person who's watching right now and thinking, I want to make it, you know, $100,000 a year. How does Withers help me do that, you know?
Totally. Yeah, great question. I love that question. Because I think that it's a bold thing to claim. And I do think that our product really does deliver on that, just based even on like what people say back to us. Like, we have customers coming to us all the time saying, like, I won my first five-figure contract ever. Like, I took my first vacation since 2019 because I'm able to win slightly bigger projects. Mm. And, you know, I'm not pitching as much, or I'm closing more projects. So the big thing that drives like the project win rate. And so we have a couple of North Stars as a company. As a company overall, the North Star is put more money into independents' pockets, like help people make more money. Functionally, at a product level underneath that is help people win more work. And so the metric that we really measure and that everything sort of ladders into from a product standpoint is called a project win rate, which is basically on a monthly basis, how many projects were created and then how many projects were won, as in like they were signed by clients or there's an invoice associated with them, et cetera. Over the last year, we've increased the project win rate on our platform by literally 6x. It's like it went from like 5% to like 30%. That's really how we know that our data, our tools, and our resources are helping people earn more money on a larger level. On a more granular level, like day-to-day for the freelancer, there's a couple of things that I think people come to us for, depending on the stage of your business. If you're somebody freelancing on the side or kind of just getting started, a lot of people come to us to help establish, like, how much do I charge and what types of services can I offer? And so the database really, really helps with that. You can think of it almost as like you browse this big library of all these different services and you can see sort of how other people are breaking down their projects. It's almost like a bunch of blueprints, I would say, with pricing involved. So it's like you want to do a website redesign. Okay, there's four phases in this. Phase one is discovery. Within discovery, you're going to audit the competitors. You're going to, you know, audit social media, et cetera. And the thing that we hear a lot from people is, oh, wow, like I've been doing these things. Like I know how to do brand strategy, but I haven't been charging for them. I didn't realize that I should be scoping in like client check-ins or like kickoff calls or like stakeholder interviews, like all these things that they just didn't realize necessarily maybe that they could charge for, were suddenly in front of them, really thoroughly built out, detailed. And they were realizing like, I do all of these things, but I'm not getting paid for it. I'm just kind of building that into it. Like people don't realize. Yeah. So a lot of it comes down to what we hear is like, I didn't realize that I could be charging for those things. And then the third bucket is like the rate itself. Now, when it comes to how to set your rates, there's a bunch of options in the market. Everybody kind of does it differently. You could do hourly, you could do flat rate. There's about a bunch of opinions about all that. But at the end of the day, at the core of it, this is a really emotional exercise, because when you are asked to put a price tag on yourself, how much should I cost an hour? It sort of can send you into kind of this existential crisis of like,
right.
Like, do I deserve this? And like, how could I justify this? And like, if you find it,
that is a big
emotional
problem. Yeah.
It's emotional really quickly. And for us, a big paradigm shift is that we took the price tag off of people. We put the price tag on the work. How much is this work worth? How much do we charge for a logo? How much is that logo worth to this client? Like, the logo lives everywhere on the website,
right?
On t-shirts, on everything. Did it cost them $5? No, probably not. So I think for us, like, we had to take that to remove both like the emotional side of it, as well as a lot of the variables and complexity with hourly rates. We had to really take the price out of people, put it on the work. And now we're having an objective conversation suddenly in sales when I'm selling to my client. Now we're talking about, okay, we might need a little bit of this strategy, but maybe not that. Or, oh, we could add on a few plugins here and there, which we think will really help people book more calls, sales calls, whatever it is. Like, now you're having more of a functional conversation. You're not having a conversation about like, how much are you worth, and you prove yourself. And I think that is really, that mental shift has really helped people get out of their own way. for lack of a better term, and really like learn their worth and really learn and understand like the work that I'm creating, the things that I'm making are worth a lot right. to clients, are worth a lot to people. And I need to start thinking of it that way rather than thinking about.
How powerful is Cox Internet? So powerful that one day your daughter will be able to simulate a soccer match against some of the world's best players right from your backyard. Get gig speeds powered by fiber from Cox. It's internet built for tomorrow, today. Internet delivered through Cox's hybrid fiber coax network. Speeds vary and are not guaranteed. Cox terms and other restrictions apply.
Why?
If you have T-Mobile 5G home internet, you might be hearing this
Why?
A lot.
Why?
Every time your internet slows down during the busiest hours.
Why?
Why?
Because your network gives priority to cell phone users.
Why?
Good question. Why not switch to Cox Internet with 2x faster download speeds than T-Mobile 5G home internet during peak hours?
Okay.
Stop the whys and visit cox.com/5G home for details. T-Mobile prioritizes certain T-Mobile phone users over home internet users during times of congestion.
At any given moment, like, what am I worth? Because you may be really experienced in one area and not in the other, or you might even live in one place and not in the other. And what does that mean for how much you should charge? You know, there's a lot of questions there. So I think having a standardized system is really, really important. And introducing that has really helped people win bigger projects and raise their rates. Like, they were like, I've been charging half as much for this. Same work.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. That's something that is very prevalent, especially like in the freelance community. People, you know, struggle a lot with, you know, knowing their self-worth and just like, there's a lot of mental exercise, like you said, you know, a lot of anxiety with, should I even charge this much? Like, are they going to pay? Like, am I even, how good am I? I mean, what makes me think I can charge this much? So on the freelancer side, you mentioned like the first bucket is like the tool that helps you like be productive, that helps you like get work done. Then the second bucket is the scope, helping you outline what you need to do and what you need to be charging for that sometimes gets overlooked, which happens a lot of times. Sometimes I mean, in my early days as a freelancer, I mean, I would get on calls, you know, with clients, you know, with potential clients, and I would spend hours and hours on these calls a week when I like aggregate them, and I'm just not, they just not get back to me. And I would be chasing them around with emails. Did you get my proposal? Did you do this? And I just never chat for those calls. Then, I mean, at this stage I'm right now, if I'm going to get on a call with you, I'm charging for it, even if it's a dollar, you know, depending on, I mean, depends on how much I think, you know, that time is worth to me. And the third scope, you know, the third bucket is pricing, you know, knowing how much you're worth by, you know, essentially talking to a community that's already doing what you're doing and knowing that, okay, this person charges X for this, I can probably charge the same thing, or, you know, the utility of what I am, of the product I'm giving to this client, like a logo, for example, it lives everywhere. Like, I mean, $2,000 may not cut it for me, like over the, you know, the time that this logo is going to be in existence and the benefit that they're going to derive from that, which is really awesome. I like that we're getting granular, you know, about this. And now if we move to the freelance, I mean, to the builder side, which you are as the founder of Weathos, I know a lot of, I mean, quite a few startup founders as friends, and I see what goes on behind the scenes. It's grueling, you know. I don't imagine it's different for you or, you know, for yourself and your business partner. And I just want to get into like, but the behind the scenes of it as a person, how's building been like for you? Like, you seem to be having fun doing it. Is it all fun?
Yeah, man. So it's so interesting. Like, I always joke, I've run so many different businesses at this point, just by the nature of like trying to get it figured out, that like, it's a totally different, software is a totally different beast than services. And it has its own set of challenges. I mean, software is like three-dimensional chess. You have so much data actually about what people are doing, clicking on and behaving, where they're coming from, that it's actually gets really complicated to kind of parse through like what matters most when it comes to metrics. Like what's really driving growth, what's really driving adoption. That's what makes software more complicated, is at the beginning, at the early stages. And then as you grow, as we've been scaling, you know, they say there's this term like crossing the chasm, basically, which is when you go from your initial set of like super users who are willing to kind of like overlook the bugs and, you know, talk, get on the phone with you and help you make the product better, into the mainstream that has way less patients, right? Like,
yeah,
they're getting on, they're
essentially don't care.
Yeah, exactly. Like, they're a stranger. They're like, what is this? I'm gonna onboard myself. And like, you'll lose them. You lose them a lot faster than, of course, like those early adopters. So we had to really, that transition is really challenging, because the team that, you know, tackles the first stage of that, the early adopters, sometimes is not the right team for the scale stage. And so we've had to go through, we've kept our team small instead of like bloating it with more and more people, but we have had to do some painful things in terms of just reorganization as the company grows. And I think something that's just important to me in general is like, we're always really open and honest with our employees about like where the company's at, what it needs, the stage that we're at. And we're really, we love people who can adapt to those different stages. But a lot of times, like, it just requires a different skill set. And so I think like that's one of the most painful things I would say as like a builder is like coming to the realization that things are constantly going to be evolving and changing and growing. And that means that the team is going to constantly be sort of changing and growing and whatever. And like, those are people, and that can be painful, you know, to have to go through that and have those conversations. But I love building software. I loved our service-based business. I really like, at my core, I really like to bring things into the world. Like, I love to squeeze something out of my head and into my hands. Like, that's what I love. When I used to do it for clients, it was much different. Serving them, they have a level of like sort of urgency, and things were kind of always on. Software is more predictable. It's more, you're able to be a bit more like strategic about how you want to approach things. And it sort of runs and runs no matter what. Like, if I, beforehand, if I didn't answer that client email, like, nobody's gonna answer that client email. But today, somebody can fully onboard themselves to my software without me having to talk to them at all. So it is a different beast. But in that, I think building and making sure that the features make sense, I think we've just generally done a really good job of listening to those customers. So honestly, like, the adoption early days of the MVP, super challenging. The user experience sucked. Yeah. Like, people were like, this is confusing. And we were trying to figure out, like, how do you put all this data into a software experience? Because there wasn't really much to look at in the world. Like, Glassdoor is kind of there.
Yeah.
But like, so we were just like, how do you make a user experience that's really easy to use? And so we ended up investing a lot of time and energy into UX and making sure that it felt more like a consumer platform. So for instance, browsing templates or scoping something out felt more like Pinterest or like shopping, sort of, where you're pulling out panels and you're adding things to your list, kind of like you're adding it to the cart. Just because we wanted to make that experience really accessible, and we wanted to be fully self-onboarded, so that people could just, you know, set up their studio in basically less than 10 minutes. So I think that's a challenge. It's just like getting adoption, finding the right metric that really points to adoption, and then, you know, iterating as quickly as you can on the software to get people over that hump. Because once you've lost them, usually like you've lost them. Once you get them though, they're not they coming really back. Tend to stick around.
I'm that kind of person where if I need a tool, I'm shopping around for a tool and I just Google. Like, I found a bunch of options and I just go on a bunch of free trials. And I usually make a decision in less than an hour. Okay, this tool is good for this, I've signed up to tools where I just, you know, some tools ask you to pay up front, $27 a month or whatever. And I pay and I get on the tool. Like, it's just the experience. I'm not enjoying it. I'm gone. Like, I don't care about $27. Yeah. I'm never coming back. Like, that's just the way it is. You know, I get that it must be grueling. And I must say that, you know, I have a friend who, and we've been friends now for about 10 years and, you know, since college, and they are building almost the same thing, doing almost the same thing that Withos does right now, but for the African market. It's called Full Gap. And you guys have so much in common, coming from like running an agency, a creative agency, to now building tools for creatives as well. So it's kind of, when you were like mentioning all of those things, talking about that, I can just make a lot of references to what my friends talk about and what they, you know, going through right now, even though it's the startup is just less than a year old. You know, had about 3,000 users in the first term. We could talk about it later. You know, maybe I can make an introduction.
Yeah, whatever. I mean, it's a huge market. Like, the more the better, in my opinion. Like, we need a lot of stuff. So
absolutely. Market. Yeah, especially like in the African market, is nothing. Like, even getting payments from like clients overseas is a big attic right now.
I bet we get asked for that too a lot. International payments is something we really hope to unlock at some point.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think, you know, it's a really, you know, important work that you guys are doing. So you recently, like, not maybe not so recently, but in the grand scope of time, you did something that a lot of companies haven't done or struggled to do. You raised, you know, what I consider a giant amount in your, you know, in funding, about $8 million. Am I right?
Yeah. So we raised in 2021, we raised an $8 million round. All in, we've raised about 14 through the course of the whole company.
Wow.
But yeah, that's the biggest round I've raised in one sort of like chunk, for lack of
right. I must imagine, you know, that wasn't like a simple, I mean, an easy process. If you can just like tell me what that process was like. I mean, to invest that much into a company, there must be a lot of trust, especially in the product and the founders, the people behind it. What was that process like for you? How fast were you able to do that? And just like, I mean, we're not getting into like, I mean, I know that's a different topic on its own, like fundraising, whatever, like for just person building, just the average person building, like how attainable is that, and what really goes into it, you know, getting to that point where you can approach investors and, you know, people can gladly, you know, just write a check of that amount.
Yeah. Oh man. The fundraising side of this whole venture has been my biggest learning curve, I guess I would say. So when I started the company, like, I didn't even know the difference between like an angel investor and a venture capitalist. Like, I was like, I heard that term even like a handful of times, right? Like my whole network was the advertising world. So the first like $1 million that I raised, it took me a year to get one investor to say yes. I talked to over 100 different investors. And it's really because like, I'm definitely a trial by fire person. Like, I learn quickly on my feet. So I don't, I will get as prepared as I can, but I'm not somebody who gets paralyzed by not knowing everything before I jump into a situation. So I just started to literally like Google, as anybody does. Like, I was in New York at the time, like New York City, venture capital, you know, started following a bunch of people on Twitter. I started going to like small events, panels, kind of figuring out like, what are the good ones? What are the bad ones? Who has, you know, sway in the space, and kind of just starting to meet people and build a reputation. The reputation is really important, especially when you're starting from like zero. Like, who are you is where you're starting.
Exactly.
Like, what? is probably the biggest hurdle to overcome, is to convince people like, I'll figure it out, basically. And so it took me a long time. And the first $1 million that I raised was led by a guy, Charlie O'Donnell, who's in New York. He runs a fund called Brooklyn Bridge Ventures. And I pitched him at a roundtable, like event in New York, where there was like eight of us sitting at a table, and we all got like a minute pitch.
Wow.
And we all went around or whatever. And then like two or three of us, he was like, we should follow up and like meet. And so I met with him, you know, a couple days later, et cetera, et cetera. And then finally got to him leading the round. And at that time, like, I remember when the, cause a couple of other investors came into that round to make up the whole million. When I saw $1 million in our bank account, I'd never seen that much money in my life. I was like, is this real? Like, what's going on? You get like a deer in the headlights kind of feeling. Right. You're like, okay, yeah, I guess I'll spend it.
I can
now
imagine.
Cause like, you know, a year earlier, months earlier, you're talking about, oh, if we just had 20K, like we could really make that go far. So it's a very different shift. Now, one thing I learned is I wouldn't have raised that money so soon if I were to do it again. I think that there's too much of a default, especially in the startup space, of like, get an idea, get a deck together, and then raise money before you kind of build anything. I think that with the way the market's going, those days are kind of winding down, because it's just easier than ever to get started. There's no code tools. There's things like you can build without even needing to raise any money. Even back then, there wasn't a ton, but like as the years went on, I was like, damn, we should have waited, because we could have done something as a proof of concept maybe, and not given up equity in the company so early. So I'm really grateful for those early investors, because they really, really helped us like get it together. But I think that adding outside capital to a situation always will add pressure. And I think that anybody who wants to raise money that's not like from a traditional bank or something like that, needs to really deeply consider like what those expectations are going to be from those investors, and how that's going to change how you manage your business, grow your business, et cetera. Because these guys, the venture capitalists, they're not looking for me to sell my company for $10 million. Even $50 million is not appealing. Even $100 million to some of the sizes of those funds is like, that's nice, but doesn't do much for my returns because it's a billion-dollar fund. So, like, I think signing up for that is a big thing, and it does add a layer of kind of complexity on top of what is already complicated, which is, like, trying to start a company. That said, running or starting to grow a company with no capital is so grueling, and we've bootstrapped the businesses before these things, and, like, it's so grueling and it's so stressful. And so there is obviously also a kind of a peace of mind that comes with it. But I think outside capital can be like a hell of a drug. And if you get hooked on it and dependent on it, then you suddenly are really not controlling the destiny of your business. And that can leave people feeling really like disillusioned, right. I guess.
Yeah.
Subsequent rounds were easier just because I had built the network up. So like it wasn't as hard to get introductions, but as you get further along, the bar gets higher. They expect more traction. They expect your unit economics to be amazing, like especially in today's market after the crash in the last like year. And so, you know, there's a learning curve, but I guess what I would say is one, it can be done. It can be done.
That's good to know.
if that's a route you want to go, like it can be done. You can figure out a way. Two, I read a lot of books. A lot of them were bad. There's one great one. It's called Venture Deals. And that book goes into more of the psychology behind these firms, how they make decisions, why they make decisions, what kind of returns they expect. Like just better understanding the system and the people in the system helped me better understand how to, you know, get into the system and basically convince them that they should back me. So I think that book really, really helped me just kind of better understand that. And then the third thing is like, just take a swing. Don't be precious. Don't be too precious about it. You'll get feedback. You know, like I like to say, like, I like to collect opinions. You'll get a million pieces of feedback. You'll get a million no's. Like you need 100 no's to get one yes for sure. But I think that too many people like think about what they want to do instead of just going ahead and doing it. And the best way to find out if there is interest or appetite is to just start trying to network and find people. I used to stalk people down on panels. Literally, I'd be like, okay, I want to meet this VC. They're sitting on a panel on Thursday. I'm going to go there. I'm just going to walk up to them after, introduce myself and get their card. And then I'm out. Like not even try to pitch them there or anything. Just be like, working on this thing. I think you'd love it. Is it okay if I have your card? And you know, I'd love to follow up with you. 9 times out of 10, they're like, sure. Always get their card. Never give out your card. Nobody's ever going to fucking email you if you give out your card. Always get their card.
Always get it.
But yeah, like it's just a lot of that. It's a lot of like one day at a time, one person at a time, just grueling, like just building up that reputation. Awesome. Even if they say no, they meet you, they're in love, and then you know, it's good.
Yeah. I mean, that's, you dropped a lot of insight there. And, you know, just like I said, I have been sort of like a fly on the wall in this meeting, especially with a lot of my startup friends. It's not a lane I want to get into because I see firsthand what that is like, what toll it takes on people. And here you are just, you know, smiling through it. I imagine, you know, there must have been a lot of like internal growth that comes with that. And if so, like, what are some of the things that you do? How do you find knowledge? Because going from a solo entrepreneur to found a company, hiring people, dealing with people, especially on a day-to-day basis, and just like leading this company with so much expectations must have required you to change in some ways, like transform from who you used to be to now, I mean, this version of yourself. And I imagine it's going to take even more to get to that next level. Where do you find your learnings? Like, how do you learn? How do you build upon that, you know, previous version of yourself? You know, is it through books and meetings and just like people? What do you do? Like, I know, you know, a lot of some of my friends, you know, they do that through books and just like learning from the best. And how do you do that?
Yeah, I think my answer is painful because like the number one way I've learned lessons is the hard way, which is that I make a mistake. And when you're the CEO and you make a mistake, usually it costs somebody their job or it ruffles feathers in a really bad way. Like interpersonal dynamics, I've definitely needed to work on myself, like go within and be like, why am I reacting this way? Or what am I doing to create these types of environments in which other people are acting this way? Like employees are a mirror, actually. And like the way they behave, usually is directly tied to how you're behaving. And once you realize that, like, oh, and you recognize like, oh, they're doing that thing because I do that thing and I didn't even realize it and it's annoying and I shouldn't do it, and neither should they. then you're like, oh, okay. And so I think one thing I learned the hard way, I would say, is clarity is king. Like, people don't want you to be necessarily, they don't really want you to be like nice, quote unquote. They want you to be clear if they're not meeting expectations, or if the work is not what you wanted it to be, or whatever it might be. The worst thing a manager can do is have a problem with someone and their work and complain about it to another manager or their boss or whoever and not address it. Same thing with even a more junior employee. Like, I would really encourage anybody at any stage in their career, like, you got to air these things out. You have to address them. And I think that too many people want to be more, like, want to make sure that things are smooth and polite, and then they don't address these tougher challenges, and then people are not meeting expectations and they just didn't even know we're there. And that's not fair to anybody. That's what sets anybody up for success. So I think that's a big thing, which is like just having the courage, honestly, to be honest, to be clear. Honesty is all about delivery. I've learned a lot about using language that can help people not feel like judged in the environment. I've gotten feedback before that when I ask questions, sometimes it can feel like an interrogation. And to me, I'm just trying to understand. So even just
amplify your career through training and development solutions specifically designed for federal government professionals. From courses to help you attain or retain certification, to individualized coaching services, to programs that hone your leadership skills and business acumen, Management Concepts optimizes your professional development. Online, in person, individually, or groups, it's training that's measurably better. Learn more at managementconcepts.com. That's managementconcepts.com.
Match believes that adults date better because when you date as an adult, you get to be a little irresponsible with really responsible people. Rip the clothes off someone who actually knows how to put them away. Fall stupidly in love with someone who's actually really smart. Forget being hot. Get them to ugly laugh. Ready to crush on someone who makes you feel whole? If you know who you are and what you want in a relationship, Match is the place for you. Adults Wanted. Download the Match app today.
You know, reframing my language to like, hey, can you help me understand X instead of why did you do it this way? The tone of that creates a more non-judgmental environment, which gives me better like answers from people. They're no longer trying to say what I want to hear or figure out what I'm trying to get at. And instead they're just having an open and honest conversation about what they don't know or what they do know or how they got here. The other thing too on that end is people talk a lot. They talk past each other a lot. And they hear what they want to hear. And I realized, you know, even a couple of years ago and working with really smart people, that I was hearing things that they weren't saying. And so by pausing before I respond and saying like, okay, what I heard you say is this, because we're all constantly as humans, like we're just interpreting. We're not necessarily like listening at face value. So I pause. I'm like, okay, what I heard was this. Like, do we share this understanding first? Then I respond rather than assuming one thing we don't have a shared understanding, and now I'm kind of jumping on them for something that they're like, wait, that's not what I meant, or that that isn't what I'm, whatever. So I think that communication has been really important, and I'm really, you probably tell, like, I'm an intense person. So being able to kind of use that when it makes sense into my advantage, but also mitigate it and, you know, become more of like a calm presence, I think has been a big thing that I've tried to work on, and that I think that a lot of entrepreneurs don't spend enough time thinking about, you know, how am I communicating and how is it influencing the information that I'm getting from my employees?
Yeah, interesting. I mean, a lot of, like, I would say the bulk of the change. Now, let me use that theory that you just shared now. What I'm understanding is that, you know, a lot of the change that you've had to make as being very solely in dealing with people, be it communication and, you know, just leadership, which I think is really, really important. And that is a nice segue into the, you know, the landscape that we're in right now, which is, you know, remote work. You know, everybody wants to work from home these days. And I imagine, you know, a bulk of the employees or the staff at Weathos, you know, works remotely. How do you handle, you know, all of the interesting dynamics that come around with, you know, working remotely. Because a lot of people watch this, even myself, like I say that I would probably never go back to the office and whatnot. But it's been a lot of like learning and changing, you know, the way I approach work. What are your thoughts on the entire remote work thing? I know a lot of business leaders are very torn on this subject. Some feel like, what, you know, people like Elon Musk thinks people are less productive when they work from home, and some, you know, believe that remote work is the future. What's your position on that?
My position on this is, like, when I hear that about, like, you know, Elon and like executive leadership, like the big banks being like, like remote work, that's not going to work for us. I have to ask a question of, like, what they're really saying is that is a question of, like, who's allowed to work remotely. And so if you're in the C-suite and you're an executive, chances are you are not in the office every day. In fact, you've never been in the office every day. In fact, you're probably working from a million different places at any given time. So you're allowed to do that even before the pandemic. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
if you're an executive at a big company like that, like Elon yesterday is at like the World Cup. You know what I mean? Like, I don't it's like, so it's not like, can we work remotely or not? What they're really saying underneath all of that is like, you're not allowed to work remotely. And I think that that comes down to this shift, I think, between the employer and the employee relationship. I think there's a big shift going on. And I think the fundamental underlying shift there is this trust factor. Like, my employees are not children. They are grown adults. And if I don't trust them to do their work, then the whole relationship deteriorates. And the best people, the best talent needs autonomy. Like, you cannot breathe down their neck all the time, because they are going to bring stuff to the table that you'll never even think of. But if you don't give them the space for that, then it's going to be a problem. And so for me, what it comes down to with remote work is, like, a remote operation is a strategy. It's a different operating strategy, and you have to approach it that way. A tool is not going to fix that. What you need is, like, actually to establish processes that make sense for a remote world. And so our company functions on a very specific schedule. We function on a set of metrics that we measure so that we know if we're moving the needle or not. And so it's not a question of, like, how many hours were you sitting in front of your computer, which I just don't believe in. It's a question of, like, how many subscribers did we get, or how did we move the needle on this, or what did we ship that was going to impact that? Like, it's very outcome oriented. And so for me, I'm like, you can do your work at 2 a.m. from the moon for all I care. But when we meet on Fridays, like we always do, I'm going to want to know, like, where are we at with things? And so it becomes clear very quickly, like, who's making an impact and who isn't. And so I think that in a remote environment, on one hand, you have one extreme in a bigger company, and granted, I have a small company, bigger company where people are coasting, no doubt, but like people are coasting no matter if they're at home or if they're in the office. It's just a question of, like, how are you actually identifying that? And if you are having trouble identifying that in the office, if you have challenges in the office operating, you're going to have exacerbated challenges when you're remote. So, you know, like, that's an operational issue, in my opinion. And then the other side of the spectrum is, like, I think some of the absolute best talent love remote because of the autonomy, because they can have more control, and because they can have the freedom to really, like, work when they're at their best, basically. And I think that that is a really, really powerful thing. So personally, I think this is kind of like a sort of a false dichotomy. I do think a lot of, I don't think we're going back fully. I know, like, people want that, but it's just not going to happen. We don't go back. We only go forward. We only go forward. So I do think that this, the pandemic just, like, totally shifted things, which is going to actually be really, really good for us, especially in the next, like, 5 to 10 years. I think it's going to open up the ability for people to design their own lives, to build work around their lives and not life around work. And that, I think, is a big, big, big shift that is going to be great for everybody. So I'm a proponent of it. I think, though, that everybody works differently, and you have to do what's best for you. There are plenty of my friends who love being in the office, and I get it. I do too, but I can be distracting, and I'm distracted. And so, you know, I have to find that balance. But I do understand it. Like, I'm not a full, like, no more office forever. Like, I do think bringing people together is fruitful. It's fun. It builds trust for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's an interesting way to put it. So, I mean, to make remote work work, it has to be trust, you know, in the people you hire, and trust in that they can accomplish, you know, their job duties and roles and just deliver. That's just the baseline of it.
And that you're able as the leader to communicate clearly and set expectations clearly and measure those expectations and measure those goals. And that way we know whether or not it's working, versus being like, let me put put spyware on your laptop so I know you're sitting in front of it for 8 hours.
Got it. Interesting. We're running out of time here. I really want to talk about a lot of things. Maybe we can, you know, bring you back at some point and just, you know, talk more about, you know, new and subjects. But, you know, finally, I just want to ask, like, how, I mean, now you're in Tennessee. I mean, a lot of people, I mean, I believe that, you know, in order to build something, quote unquote, great, you know, we have to be in Silicon Valley. But you're not in Silicon Valley right now, are you?
I'm not.
Okay. I mean, has that been able to, you know, work out for you, like, regardless? Like, I mean, how do you connect with people? How do you, you know, find you know, people who can potentially, like, invest in a company, find good talent and things of that nature? How are you able to do that from Tennessee?
Yeah, I think I'll say, like, in my early days, I didn't have the privilege of being able to not be in a big hub, I don't think. Like, I don't think I could have gotten here if I hadn't been in New York kind of hustling. Mm. There's just not the same amount of opportunity in that regard here. But again, pandemic, that was like pre-pandemic, and the pandemic just really changed everything. A lot of networking is now done online. And a lot of, like, relationship building is done online. And that makes sense. I mean, people have been falling in love online for years, right? So, of course. But I think that in order to, like, get the company off the ground, there's no denying that it was helpful to be in a big city. Mm-hmm. Now I have the privilege of being able to be somewhere else. I do still travel a good amount. I still build my network a lot. And from a hiring standpoint, I mean, to me, it opens up just so much more opportunity. We have people in New York, we have people in LA, we have people in San Francisco. And, like, so to me, it's almost like we can sort of build these distributed hubs, these distributed networks that is actually much more powerful in the long run than just having, like, all of my network concentrated in New York, which was, like, basically where I was at. And the advantage of being in a city like Nashville is we get a ton of traffic from the Southeast. The Southeast is booming with people starting businesses. And in here, like, here in Nashville, there's a whole music industry and there's a whole production industry behind that music industry. And so we get a lot of, like, production studios, music video shoots, like, people who do a lot of the production side of it. And those are totally different businesses with the same set of challenges. And so that's where, like, I think, honestly, location, you can use that, like, being different locations to your advantage. And I think it's just, like, a different approach. If I were starting over today, I'm not sure that I would say explicitly you need to be in a big city like a New York or an SF because so many people now are able to build online, like, networks online, and that's more normal. But I would say you probably need to be, like, visiting and or now today meeting somebody in person can mean a lot more. So you can actually use that to your advantage as well to, like, be selective about, okay, I really want to meet this person in person and build that relationship. I think that can be really important.
Yeah, that's interesting. Now, you kind of alluded to what I was, you know, going to ask you next, which is, if you were starting over, I'm pretty sure you must have made a lot of mistakes. You are someone who learns by doing and just, like, stumbling a lot. You know, what would you do differently? I mean, in terms of, like, the path you took. I mean, I know you mentioned that, you know, especially from the fundraising side, you probably wouldn't have, you know, raised as much money, give up, you know, as much equity, things of that nature, if, you know, things were happening like today. But, you know, those were different times. But what other things would you say that, I mean, looking back now and knowing what you know today, you would have done differently or maybe just taken a different approach?
Yeah. And so I'll go back to, like, my answer from earlier, which is, like, the fundraising side of things. I think that bringing outside capital into the situation changes a lot of stuff. And it also jolts you into, or leapfrogs, like, a lot of stages of the business into, like, okay, let's go hire a team. Because when an investor gives you money, like, they want you to spend it. And they want you to spend it and they want you to grow. Like, they don't just want you to run out of money, but they don't want you to sit on it either. Like, you can't raise $5 million and be like, okay, now we have runway for 10 years. Like, that's not their game.
Yeah, they want an exit fast.
Yeah. So they're, like, they're thinking, you know, recruit a team, recruit leadership and things like that. So anyway, I think that I would have just stayed and bootstrapping again so hard because we were, like, you know, freelancing, like, we were also, like, bartending and, like, just trying to bring in money. It can be really stressful to do that. But I do think that, like, I don't know, bringing in institutional investors so early can add an added sort of layer of complexity that you have to consider these things of, like, your consideration is, like, how do I get to the next round of funding? Right. It's not necessarily how do I get more customers, even though getting more customers tends to lead to the next round of funding, but not always, to be honest. So like the venture capitalists have like a different sort of set of things that they're assessing that have to do with extrapolating the potential of the business, not necessarily having to do with your last 3 months of growth. Like they always say, like, fundraising is a ticket to the future, not a reward for the past. So anyway, I think I would have probably been a bit more considerate about that. I think it would have gotten us a bit further along in discovering like what it is that we are, you know, creating, what is the product sort of looking like. Just because once you start having more people on the team and involved, that does create red tape. It slows things. It can slow things down, et cetera. So yeah, so in the early days, I think small and scrappy, is good. And I would have leaned into that like a little bit more for a little bit longer. And that's probably my biggest thing, which is just like, I wish I had more wherewithal to understand and consider what it meant to really bring on investors, and what kind of impact that might have on the influence over sort of like my decision-making about the business. Now, over the years, I've learned a lot and I can manage those expectations a lot better now. I don't feel like I'm getting whipped around in a million directions. But I think as a first-time founder and a new founder, it can be really challenging not to listen to people who seem to be much more experienced than you.
Interesting. Super, super interesting insights there. And thanks for sharing that. You know, I just want to round this up so we can, you know, just get you off here. I just want to ask you, you know, a bunch of, you know, questions just to get to know you better, whoever's watching is right now. And the first would be like, what do you consider fun time? How do you relax? How do you get the pressure off?
I love going outside. That's one of the best parts about moving to Nashville. Like, oh man, like trees and a lawn, like new, like windowless New York apartment. Not for me anymore. So I love to go outside. I take a lot of walks. Walking helps me think. I skate a lot at night. I go to a lot of music. That always helps me shut my brain off. It's just like live music. Can't not be present there. Yeah. And so I think like finding those things that help me be present that are not work really helps. My co-founder, like we lean on each other a lot. That has been just instrumental. And just having a partner there, and you know, when she's down, I can be up, and when I'm down, she can be up, and it really helps. Right. And then like at the end of the day, when I'm in my deepest, like when I'm in my darkest place and I'm like, what's going to happen? Is the company going to work out? You know, all these things, and you start to spiral, you're getting a million no's, whatever it is. I always go back to talking to my customers. That's where my validation comes from. If I'm building something that is providing value to those people, then a million investors can say no to me and it doesn't matter. Like that's not where I'm getting my validation from. Right. So I think like really just making it about helping people, the end customer, helps me get out of my own way, helps me get out of my own head, and reminds me what gets me out of bed in the morning. And what gets me out of bed in the morning is helping people take their first vacation since 2019, not pitching a giant VC at TechCrunch, you know, like that's two totally different things. So I think like just recentering myself and really making sure I understand what my values are and why I'm here, what gets me out of bed. That's super important to keep going.
Awesome. Awesome. Next, one single advice to one, the freelancer. Of course, you make good money being a, you know, sole creative and partnering up and whatnot. One advice to that, and one advice to that person who's thinking of building something, could be a startup, a business, whatever it is, one for each. Go.
Oh, just get started. It seems so simple, but it's the hardest part is to just get started. I think people get paralyzed by the unknown and you don't know what you don't know. And that's going to always be the case, especially as a business owner. And I think that you've got to just find a way to start somewhere, whether it's just like one email to that one person that you met.
Yeah.
However long ago, hey, I'm freelance now, or hey, I just published my portfolio. I think there's a key there too, where it doesn't have to be like an email with an ask about like, do you have any freelance work for me? It can be like, hey, I just updated my portfolio website, wanted to see what you thought. Like things like that. Just taking one thing, one step, breaking it down and just continuing to move forward. The worst thing you can do when starting a business, I think, is get analysis paralysis, where you just freeze and get paralyzed and you can't move forward. I think a lot of people suffer from that because it's hard. But at the end of the day, like you can think and plan all you want, but you've just got to get started. You've just got to find one thing you can do to start moving it forward. It's not going to happen overnight. So that's my advice. I know that seems simple, but don't overthink it.
Yeah. And I think that's, you know, where a lot of people get stuck. You know, they're just like,
I mean, either you don't know what to say or who to say to, or they're just like, there's no way this is ever going to work out. And you know what? I might as well just, you know, not do it or just quit now. Yeah. I mean, even though it sounds really simple. Yeah. You know, it really like speaks to me as a person, because like I struggle with this. That's why it's so much resonate with, you know, with that. So I, you know, just, I want to get you off here. I want to appreciate you so, so much for coming on. I mean, that one single email from, you know, from Summer, you know, it's changed everything. And I so much enjoy this conversation, because one, it's, I mean, I learned so much from me personally, and I'm pretty sure that a lot of people watching this building stuff and just like wanting to do that next big thing will take a lot of knowledge away from this conversation. So I really appreciate you doing that. You know, Rachel, so thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. This has been great. Great questions. Always happy to talk through this stuff. Like, I think I hear the same problems all over the place. So it doesn't matter what stage you're at or where you're at or what you're doing. Like, just know whatever challenges you're facing, like, you are not alone. It's the same. Everybody feels that way. So you're not alone. Thank you for having
me. That's great. Well, that'll be the end of this conversation. I will link every single detail about Rachel, about Wethos. You can check them out at, you know, in the website. I'll leave that in the description or in the show notes if you are listening to this. And where can people find you? Are you on social? How can they get in touch with you?
So you can find me on LinkedIn. You can find me on Twitter. I'm at RachelRen1. And we'll send you a link for the show notes too, so that if you sign up through that link, you can get 30 days access to the pro features for free. Ooh. So we'll pop that in there so people can check it out. And I'd love to hear from you. Don't be shy. I'm always happy to chat.
Interesting. Thank you so much. And I hope to bring you back again another time, hopefully soon, and we can chat more.
Thank you.
All right.
See you later.
Yeah, bye. I hope that episode lived up to its promise. And if it did, kindly consider subscribing to the podcast. And most importantly, leave a review. Let me know your thoughts. It really helps. And that's the conversation with Rachel Renner, the CEO and co-founder of Wethos. Again, if you want to get access to all of the pro features for Wethos for 30 days, use the link in the description or in the show notes, wherever you get your podcast from. I appreciate you listening to this episode, and hopefully you will be here for the next one. We have an interesting lineup of guests for the upcoming episodes, and if you are interested in building something or you're a freelancer right now, a one-man business, this episode will be of great help to you. Once again, thanks for listening, and I will see you in the next episode. I'm Daniel Falonibe. Take care now. Bye.